Welcome to Elevate. This is a new podcast that we're putting together. I'm Ben Gideon.
I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
I'm in Maine. Rahul, where do we find you today?
Los Angeles today, every day.
So we've got coasts from Maine all the way to Los Angeles. I think we've got pretty much the domestic United States covered.
When you reached out to me to talk about starting this podcast, I was so excited for a couple of reasons. First of all, I have so much respect for you and all that you do, but the idea of actually reaching out coast to coast and trying to get the best people in the industry on the podcast to talk about a little twist, which is not focusing on particular cases and techniques on how to cross-examine a particular expert or the motion and procedural practice of getting exhibits in opening statement, but really focusing on the human aspect of being a trial lawyer and how to have all of us succeed for the long term for the benefit of our clients while also having happy lives. I just thought that was the best idea ever, and it really speaks to the core of what I strive to do in life, but often fail to do. So I'm really excited about this podcast and doing it with you.
Yeah, I feel the same way, Raul. It's interesting because I first got to know you through a podcast. I heard you as a guest on a podcast where you were talking about your $100 million plus verdict against the casino in Nevada. And you sounded like an amazing lawyer. And then we got to know each other a little bit in Tucson last year in the induction at the American College. And I thought you'd be such a great partner in this venture. I'm really excited about this because I do enjoy listening to podcasts. I've been a trial lawyer for about 19 years now. And one thing that I've learned over that time is that I find that there are lawyers who become really skilled at the nuts and bolts of doing the practice. They're good at depositions. Maybe they've got all the technique down. But the people who are really great at what we do just bring something intangible, an X factor that it's really hard to describe. But it's the thing that I've been most curious about in learning about and trying to grow myself over the years. What is that thing that makes some people just really great at this? And, you know, other people are striving to find that. So that's been my journey. And part of my journey has also involved my own personal struggles. I've had challenges myself along the way. I've certainly had some amazing successes, but also some really disappointing failures. And every time, you know, something like that happens, I find I have to re-examine, try to make myself better. And I'm really excited to kind of continue that journey now with you through this podcast and the people, our guests that we're going to bring on the show to talk with us. Can I just ask, Raul, so tell us a little, I mean, you've had an amazing career. Folks who are interested can read more about that in your bio, but can you tell us a little bit about your journey? I mean, my experience, every trial lawyer who's had success has had to have a personal journey, struggles, challenges, things you've had to overcome to get where you are today.
Yeah, my journey started with even trying to go to law school. My mom is a double master's in nuclear engineering and environmental engineering. My dad, a PhD chemical engineer, and my brother, a doctor. And the concept of anybody in our family following a pursuit or dream that was outside the science community was obscene. And at the time I applied to law school, actually on the cover of Newsweek magazine was a person holding up a sign that said, "I'll work for food." And it was the number one graduate of UCLA law school. And so the law community was struggling. Back in the late 90s, 96 is when I went to law school, and I had a family that was absolutely against me going to law school, but it was just something I really wanted to do. It was probably for the wrong reasons. I just felt I was extra feisty and would always push back on any issue, sometimes just to be a contrarian, and sometimes it's just what I believed in. And I felt like I could be a really good advocate for the underrepresented. So I pushed and followed my dreams, but I followed it like a rudderless ship. And I went into law school thinking I wanted to be an environmental engineer, partly inspired by my mom. And then I realized that an environmental engineer really focuses on regulatory issues, and that almost made me want to fall asleep. But through that, I worked at the Ventura prosecutor's office in Ventura County, started trying cases there, really sophisticated cases, the kind that nobody else could win except for me. They were fishing without a license trials, and I had 100% conviction rate. It was pretty amazing. And and while I was there, then I got a call from one of my buddies from my first year class who worked at this firm that was called Green, Broillette, Taylor, Wheeler, and Panish. And he called me up and he said, "Hey man, there's a partner over here that needs a law clerk and you should come here. This is an amazing firm." I didn't know the firm. I didn't know what they did. And I didn't own a suit. Well, I had one, but I just used it for that trial I had the other day. And so I just got dressed up in the nicest clothes I could find, made it over there. And that firm just had a bunch of cool people in it who were working on catastrophic injury and wrongful death cases. And the fact patterns were so gut-wrenching and so inspiring that I wanted to work there and to work on that type of stuff the moment I heard about it. And it just opened up my eyes to a whole world of litigation that I then pursued for my entire career. So I stayed there for a couple of years, then went to a bigger firm to do toxic torts and worked on that Aaron Brockovich case and antitrust cases. And then when Brian Panish spun off, I jumped back on with him, and I've been with him for 15 or so years now. And I just absolutely love what I do. And I want everybody to be trial lawyers, and I want everybody to love what they do as lawyers. And I've seen so many people burn out throughout the years, big firm lawyers, doesn't matter, immigration lawyers, employment lawyers, trial lawyers. And I'm doing my earnest best to try and get people to kind of keep their compass focused north, not focus on money, but focus on just doing the right thing, and everything else seems to work out.
And you also teach trial practice at a local law school, correct?
I do. I've been teaching for 12 years, and I actually am starting a brand new project with the dean of the law school. I want to see, now that we're in this digital world that we've been in for the last year and some change, I want to see what we can do as lawyers to actually take advantage of remote jury trials, expediting cases. And so we're going to retry 20 cases, but do it with remote juries, the same lawyers, the same judges, and do it on a shortened time schedule, compare them to the verdicts that actually happened, and see if we can find ways to actually improve and speed up the wheels of justice.
Wow, that's really, sounds like a really cool project, and very timely with the pandemic and court closures.
Yep. Yep.
That may be the only way to get justice for the foreseeable future. And your colleague, Brian Panish, just got a great verdict in a remote trial, correct?
He did. Well, it wasn't a remote trial. So Brian, because of the pandemic, and LA County and LA Superior Court is one of the largest court systems in the country, but because it's the largest, I think it's suffering from being the least nimble through this process. And as a result of that, we've been closed down, and it's been very hard to have any jury trials. So Brian actually did a bench trial in front of a judge in LA Superior Court. Took about 2 weeks, and the offer, I think, was $3 million before the trial. It was a leg injury case, and the verdict was $23 million, or the judgment, I should say, because it was a ruling by the court.
And about 4 days later, your firm settled a case for approximately $40 million in a separate case, right?
Yeah, it was a heat stroke, a tragic case against Cal State San Bernardino. That one, actually, the jury trial started in December, 8 days of jury selection, and then the occupancy of the ICU beds in San Bernardino were at 99% capacity. And so then the judge stayed the case and continued it to February, and before we could start up again, the case resolved.
And even by the standards of Panish, Shea, and Boyle, approximately $60 million in settlements in 1 week ain't so bad.
Not so bad.
That's about the gross domestic product of my entire state here in Maine, just so you know.
One thing we like to do, and I know, Ben, you do too, is try to figure out if there's ways that we can actually get prevention too. And so we really focus on non-monetary relief. So while the numbers may sound staggering at almost $60 million in recoveries for our clients, I think what's also valuable is that we were able to actually get reform on that Cal State San Bernardino case. So hopefully heat strokes, which are sadly all too common, don't happen again.
So I really was interested in your pathway through to the law. Mine's almost a diametric opposite. I was the son of a law professor. So I grew up with the law as part of my life from day one. My father thought it was fun to utilize the Socratic method every evening at the dinner table. So we had arguing about things was kind of the core of my relationship with my father. It still is to this day. It's an interesting dynamic because it's kind of how we show our love for each other. We yell and argue with each other. My mother was not a fan of that. She would often storm off from the dinner table in frustration while we sat there arguing with each other. But it taught me at a young age to not just how to argue or frame an argument, but actually the love of argument. I enjoyed the process of taking a side and advocating for a position. Although I resisted the idea of going to law school for a little while and took some time off after college, for me, it was almost inevitable that I would end up there eventually. And I did end up going to law school. I graduated from Yale Law School in 1999, the same law school that my father had gone to. But rather than go into the world of academia, I decided I was going to go and practice at a big law firm. So I did a one-year clerkship for a judge on the First Circuit Court of Appeals up in his chambers were in Maine. And then I moved down to New York City to work for a big national, international corporate law school doing litigation. And I had a reasonably good experience there. I learned a lot. But one thing I learned was that that isn't what I wanted to do with my life and my career. You know, God gives you a certain amount of time on this earth and certain talents, and you have to decide where you want to use those. And I concluded that the Enrons and the Arthur Andersons and the other large corporations of the world that I had spent time representing down there, they were always going to find pretty darn good lawyers to represent them. And, you know, I wanted to find other people, other things to do with my career.
I remember meeting your dad in Arizona, actually. He's a really nice man. And I did not see the fervent arguments going on between you and your dad. So you've really refined it over the years.
Yeah, it's improved a little bit.
But that's really cool. I mean, you follow in your father's footsteps, so obviously he was an inspiration to you.
Yeah, he definitely was. And, you know, it's interesting because in some ways you can relate to this probably, but in the world of the law, kind of the highest stature job you can have is to be a law professor. Now, law professors are kind of revered. Students certainly revere them and look up to them. And they're very difficult jobs to get to be a tenured professor at any school. And, you know, by contrast, the plaintiff's lawyer, which is often associated with kind of lowbrow activities, accident chasing, injury law, is considered to be kind of a lowbrow area of the practice of law. And I've always kind of struggled a little bit with the idea that, you know, I haven't really lived up to my father's expectations of me by going into this lower brow, if you will, niche of law. And one thing that I'm so excited about in doing this podcast is I really don't believe that being a plaintiff's lawyer has to be, you know, a lowbrow practice. I think it can be a really high-level practice. And that's what we've attempted to achieve in our practice. Our mission is to take the same kind of intensity and intelligence and resources that the big companies get when they're litigating cases and be able to give that to the underdog that is fighting against the system. Whether they're, and I do now mostly medical negligence cases. So in our cases, they're all against large hospital companies or, you know, major medical providers or employers. And they always get the best lawyers. They always get the best experts. And now we're able to offer that same level of representation to our clients. And it really feels great to do that and to level the playing field for our clients.
So. Yeah. And even when they have somebody like you representing them, you're still in a David versus Goliath situation. and you've got all the resources that you can put to it, but you don't have all the bodies that you can put to it like these big firms and big corporate defendants have. So they'll have 20 lawyers defending against you. And it's kind of an empowering feeling knowing that they need 20 to fight you.
It really is. And I mean, how many depositions have you walked into, Raul, where it's just you on one side and a dozen lawyers on the other side of the table, and every one of them is there to slit your throat?
Yep.
But it feels pretty good, you know?
It really does, especially, you know, I think at the end of the day, you're very selective and we're very selective on the cases that we get involved in because we want to make sure that we can actually provide a benefit to our clients. And the way we do that is by knowing that we're in a position to actually succeed more often than not. And so going in and then seeing those 12 lawyers ready to slit your throat, and then by the time the depositions are done, the truth has come out, and seeing the looks on their faces, as I say, see you at the next one. It's a really good feeling for me as an advocate and knowing what we can do for our clients.
What one thing I'm interested in exploring in this podcast is, you talked about it, Raul, but kind of the human factor that goes into this. I mean, how many nights have you spent in cheap hotels away from your family, waking up to a bad hotel breakfast, and then, you know, carrying your litigation bag over to some courthouse you've never stepped your foot in before? And when you do that, everything relating to your case ends up being there with you being carried by you into that courthouse. A lot of times there's a kind of a lonely feeling to that, and a feeling like, you know, can I manage all that pressure, all that, everybody's expectations for what I need to bring to that moment when I have to perform? There's a performance element to this job. And in those moments, the only way you get through those and you persevere and shine is some kind of strength of character and reservoir of energy and ability, reserve, whatever you want to call it, that allows you to carry through in those moments. And it's just an interesting dynamic. You know, I've been there many times and it can be isolating and lonely and scary, honestly. And but it's also exhilarating and part of the job. What do you think about all that?
I agree with all of that. And, you know, being a trial lawyer and going to different venues, I still haven't tried a case in front of the same judge twice. And so it's always a new situation. A lot of times I don't have the hometown advantage. And so there are a lot of pressures that come in. And over the years, the way I cope with it has been different. And this is one of the things I'm excited about through the podcast is learning from the best of the best and the guests that we have on here. I think that all of them are teaching me different opportunities and different ways to learn to be a better trial lawyer at the really core level, and learning different ways to cope with all of the taxes associated with being a trial lawyer. But there is nothing more exhilarating than the reading of the verdict. I don't know about, what do you think, Ben? That moment before it comes in, when you hear the double buzz and you know the verdict's coming.
Even before you get the reading of the verdict, you get the knock on the door, and then you get the, we have a verdict, or maybe you're not quite right there where the court officer is, so they buzz you on your cell phone and say, Mr. Ravaputi, we have a verdict. And just the anxiety and the kind of chill that runs down your spine as you're waiting for the verdict to come back, and then you see the jury come in and the foreperson hand that to the court officer, and the court officer walk it over to the clerk or the judge, depending on the protocol in the courthouse, and the judge scanning it over, and you're trying to read the judge's facial expressions to see, you know, what that verdict is, and then the reading. And it, and every verdict, it's like etched into my mind. I'll never forget any one of them, good or bad.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I remember the bad more than the good, though. There's no lesson that I haven't learned better from a loss than a win.
There's no question about that. And I mean, one of the common themes of every books or discussions with people that have been highly successful is the ability to lose. Because with this business, if you can't lose, you can't try cases. And if you can't learn from your losses, you can't get better at trying cases. Very early on in my legal career, I actually got a verdict that I technically won, but the amount was lower than I wanted. So I felt like it was a loss. And that evening after the verdict, I went to a local bar and I drank a lot. And then I went and I slept the rest of the night in my car because I was too drunk to drive home. And when I woke up the next morning, I didn't have any clue where I was. But then I looked around and noticed that I was in a parking lot and next to a bar. So I pieced it together and I drove home. When I walked in the door, my wife was there with our three little kids. We had three kids under the age of five. And my wife says, "Don't ever do that again." And I realized at that moment that if I couldn't figure out how to lose, I couldn't continue to do this job.
Yeah, no, it's true. That actually gets to one of the important things that I have to keep reminding myself, which is this isn't about me and my feelings on each particular trial. It's about just doing the best we can do for our clients. And before that verdict's read, if I know that I did the best that I could have done, and that's really the soul searching moment is before that verdict comes in, then I have to make peace with whatever the outcome is and get ready to pick myself back up and do the best for my client on the next case and hopefully get a different outcome.
We're really excited for this journey and we're excited to have you along for the ride. We hope that you'll reach out to us, send us an email, join our Facebook group. Let's keep the discussion going after the show and offline. And I want you to also hold our feet to the fire. Our promise is to make this show real, to talk to our guests in a real way and not just accept kind of BS, if you will, to go underneath the surface, to ask the hard questions. This is not a show about bragging about verdicts or just getting guests on to tout their own greatness. It's really to explore these difficult and deeper issues. So if we're not doing that, hold our feet to the fire and call us up or email us and tell us we know how to do a better job. But with that, we're really excited for this show. We hope you enjoy it. Now let's get going on it.